in May of 2016 when I was serving as an active duty Army officer in Kuwait in the command headquarters of the counter-ISIS operation Inherent Resolve. I filed a lawsuit against then President Obama for violations of the War Powers Resolution. I was the lead plaintiff in that case. I couldn't tell anyone in Kuwait while this was all going on. So basically no one there knew. I couldn't tell my chain of command, obviously, because the fear was they would redeploy me back home to the States. I was sitting there and I printed out the paperwork and I signed it. And after I'd scanned it and had uploaded it and was sitting there getting ready to send the email, and I remember hesitating for a minute because I knew that as soon as I pushed that button, you know, there's no bringing it back.
Welcome to Newsbeat, an unconventional examination of conventional wisdom. Newsbeat is produced and distributed by MP Studios, a division of Mori Publishing. Newsbeat. Listen. Learn.
Hey, everybody. This is Mike Conforti, a.k.a. Manny Faces, producer of Newsbeat. We're glad you could join us once again for another episode. Newsbeat is brought to you by our sister company, Mori Publishing, an inbound marketing agency based in New York, specializing in web design, content marketing, and sales support. Check them out at moripublishing.com. So this episode takes a hard look at America's unconstitutional, never-ending state of war. I say unconstitutional because, as you'll learn, according to the U.S. Constitution, only Congress possesses the power to declare war, yet it hasn't done so since World War II. How, then, have we been waging war across the globe for the past 75 years, the latest incarnation being our ongoing war on terror? Helping us to understand this and explaining these wars' most recent facilitator, the 2001 Authorization for Use of Military Force, or AUMF, is one of the leading intellectuals of our generation, Dr. Cornel West, also professor of the practice of public philosophy at Harvard Divinity School.
Bush has 45 drone strikes and Obama has over 500. Bush is a war criminal, but Obama's not. But see, that's ridiculous. You gotta be morally consistent.
Elizabeth Beavers, foreign policy manager at nonprofit Indivisible.
You know, as we all learned in ninth grade civics class, it's the responsibility constitutionally for Congress to declare war, Congress to authorize military force. It's not for the president.
And United States Army Captain Nathan Smith, one of the countless U.S. servicemen and women risking their lives to fight these illegitimate wars, who sued the Obama administration over the constitutionality of the current war against ISIS.
When this action was taken and we start going outside of the framework of the Constitution, we're going outside of the framework of the oath that I took.
A special guest artist for this episode is musician and songwriter Greg Tannen. Buckle in, folks. This is AUMF, the latest weapon in America's illegal perpetual war.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated.
Hi, Nathan Smith. My family is a three-generation military officer family. My grandfather, who's still living and is 95 years old, is a World War II vet, former fighter pilot.
And I will support and defend the Constitution.
My dad was a Navy captain. My mom was a Navy captain.
Against all enemies.
My sister served as an officer, and my uncle served as an officer.
Foreign and domestic.
So military service is something that my family takes great pride in. There was a point in time where I was extremely open to the prospect of a 20-year career in the military, as both of my parents did. But, you know, I feel very strongly that the circumstances that are existing now, such that they were in Kuwait, where I am not at all confident that I am able to live out that commissioning oath to support and defend the Constitution, that's an untenable situation for me. The situation that we had in 2015 and 2016 when I was part of the command headquarters in Kuwait that was overseeing the counter-ISIS mission, Operation Inherent Resolve, was that for, at that point, over 2 years, the specific mission that was ongoing there had not been formally approved by Congress. The Obama administration at the time was saying that they had sufficient authorization from Congress to go forward with that mission because following 9/11 in 2001, there had been an authorization for the use of military force, which Congress voted on and gave the president at that time and then going forward the authority to go after the perpetrators of 9/11, basically. The Obama administration was claiming more or less that ISIS was an offshoot of Al-Qaeda and therefore they had the sufficient legal authorization from Congress to engage ISIS in a military action. The problem was that that's a view that is really not shared by anyone in the intelligence community or the military. ISIS evolved years after 9/11, and it's well known that in parts of the Middle East, ISIS and Al-Qaeda affiliates were in direct conflict. It was a completely nonsensical legal argument that the administration was making, and that's problematic to me as a military officer who took an oath to support and defend the Constitution, because the Constitution clearly states that only Congress has the authority to declare war.
I went to the Great War in 2001. So did you, my son. You might not know it, the news won't show it, but you were sent to war in 2001. The war's not won, 'cause this war's never done. The war's not won, 'cause this war's never
really is amazing. This thing has been with us for, you know, more than 15 years. It has had such an impact on American culture and the things that we see all around us every day and we get used to. And yet, I think a lot of people don't even know it exists. So, you know, right after the attacks of 9/11 back in 2001, there was this sort of rush to respond. And then President Bush was really interested in launching this kind of so-called global war on terror. And you know, as we all learned in ninth grade civics class, it's the responsibility constitutionally for Congress to declare war, Congress to authorize military force. It's not for the president. So then President Bush went to Congress and asked for force authorization. So what Congress came back with and what they ended up passing was only one sentence long. And somebody called it the most dangerous sentence in U.S. history, and I don't think that's an exaggeration. It basically, by its language, authorized the president to use force anywhere, anytime, any place that he deemed necessary and appropriate against those involved with the attacks of 9/11. There weren't any geographic restrictions. There wasn't a date where it expired. There wasn't any sort of definition of actually who those people were or who that enemy might be, what the objectives would be of using force. You know, nearly unanimously, Congress voted for this thing that's on a bipartisan basis kind of at the time in the name of, you know, finding unity and achieving security. But there was one person who voted against it. Her name was Barbara Lee. She was the only person who voted no. And I really encourage people, look up on YouTube her floor speech from that day, because she talks about not letting the United States become the evil we deplore as we respond to this tragedy.
However difficult this vote may be, some of us must urge the use of restraint. Our country is in a state of mourning. Some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control. Now, I have agonized over this vote. But I came to grips with it today, and I came to grips with opposing this resolution during the very painful yet very beautiful memorial service. As a member of the clergy so eloquently said, as we act, let us not become the evil that we deplore. Thank you, and I yield the balance of my time.
You know, what was so amazing about that is this one sentence, this force authorization, really has been used for that purpose. Three administrations now have used that one sentence to justify a whole range of things as part of that global war on terror.
There's one big sentence that we all have to serve. A lifetime sentence that we barely observe. We got scared on a Tuesday in fall. We strike back at anyone at all. And this war's not won, 'cause this war's never done. And this war's not won, 'cause this war's never done.
Here we are in 2017, and it's been used to justify ongoing military operations that are happening right now against ISIS in Iraq and Syria.
Tonight I want to speak to you about what the United States will do to degrade and ultimately destroy the terrorist group known as ISIL.
Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched.
Military force in Libya, Somalia, Yemen, of course, Afghanistan and Iraq. And there's so many other places where military operations have taken place.
Over the last several years, we have consistently taken the fight to terrorists who threaten our country. We took out Osama bin Laden and much of Al-Qaeda's leadership in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We've targeted Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Yemen and recently eliminated the top commander of its affiliate in Somalia.
It's really just incredible because, you know, members of Congress have said since then, you know, I didn't think I was voting for war in Syria in 2016, 2017, when I passed this sentence back in 2001. But that's kind of exactly the lesson, which is that by giving that broad authority, Congress kind of abdicated its role in war-making authority, and it now just falls in the hands of the executive branch to interpret and to utilize it in that way. And so just thinking really kind of pragmatically, if you're a president and you don't have to go back to Congress to ask permission for something, Why would you?
The imperial policy, when it comes to the military-industrial complex, when it comes to drone strikes, when it comes to dropping bombs, especially on Muslim countries, the difference between a Hillary Clinton and a Donald Trump and a Barack Obama is very, very small on that international front. Domestically, there is a difference. No doubt about that, about rights and liberties and so forth. There is a difference. But on the international front, very little. And that's part of the problem of trying to keep track of the American empire and its policies, even as you keep track of the American domestic activities that's going on. The two are tied together. But it's hard in the corporate media to keep track of them. The media doesn't even believe America's an empire, even though they are an integral part of the empire. And if they were to be honest about their role in the empire, it would be hard to remain the corporate media. Bush has 45 strikes, drone strikes, and Obama has over 500. Bush is a war criminal, but Obama's not. Well, see, that's ridiculous. You know, you got to be morally consistent, see. So that when we talk about neoliberalism, you're talking about a way of privatizing, militarizing, that collapses public space, public conversation, public accountability, public answerability for elites at the top.
Afghanistan, Libya, Pakistan, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq. Parent and child made to fight the same fight, and we don't know when they're coming back. This war's not won, this war's never done. This war's not won, 'cause this war's never done.
I was supportive of the military objectives in the sense that, you know, I found ISIS to be a reprehensible enemy. And it didn't bother me from an ethical standpoint, the military action that we were taking against them. You know, I was a soldier and I had served in Afghanistan in 2012. And that was also against an enemy that I found to be reprehensible. But to me, the process matters, because when I took that oath, you know, a lot of times in the military, people use a saying that when you take your commissioning oath or your enlistment oath, you're writing a check to the U.S. government up to and including your own life. That kind of illustrates how seriously people in the military take that oath. And that's how I viewed it. I think it's kind of a two-way agreement in a certain sense, in that I am writing a check up to and including my own life, but I'm writing that check because I believe in the system of government and the Constitution of the United States, and I believe that it sets a moral ethical framework for me to use whatever abilities I have to risk my life or apply lethal force on others if that's so needed. I felt like that when this action was taken and we start going outside of the framework of the Constitution, we're going outside of the framework of the oath that I took, because I didn't take an oath to serve in a system where the president unilaterally declares war and deploys troops.
If all members could raise their right hand.
Would you please raise your right hand?
I, Nathan Smith.
I'm going to read the entire oath.
Having been appointed an officer in the Army of the United States.
And you will respond appropriately.
As indicated above in the grade of second lieutenant.
Do you solemnly swear
that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies,
foreign and domestic. That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That you take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservations or purpose of evasion,
and that you will well and faithfully,
and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which I am about to enter.
So help you God.
So help you God.
So help me God. We are supposed to be a system and a government of laws, so it's important that we follow those and that we don't deviate from that. But furthermore, it's important because I think the separation of powers that the founders set up in the Constitution, which gave Congress the sole authority to declare war, or in this case, pass an AUMF, was done for a purpose. And you see this in the letters of all the founding fathers, or many of the founding fathers, where they talk about that was a conscious choice that they made. They did not want the executive, you know, the president, to have the ability to unilaterally take the nation from a state of peace to a state of war. They'd seen that happen in Europe, and that's not what they wanted for our system of government.
I rise today to oppose unauthorized, undeclared, and unconstitutional war. What we have today is basically unlimited war anywhere, anytime, any place upon the globe. Not only is it the lives that we are losing, the American soldiers, the brave young men and women who were sent to distant lands and asked to give their life for their country without the Senate taking the time to authorize the war, I think that is terribly unjust and should end. Madison wrote that the executive branch is the branch most prone to go to war. Therefore, the Constitution, with studied care, vested that power in the Congress. You see, our founding fathers saw the history of Europe as the perpetual history of war. Brothers fighting brothers, kings of two different countries who were cousins, brothers, uncles, fathers, sons. The history of Europe was perpetual war. When we broke away, we said, we are going to have some checks and balances in place. We are going to make it difficult to go to war. We are going to vest that power in the Congress. But somewhere along the way, we lost our way. And we now commit ourselves to war. Or one man or one woman commits us to war without any vote by Congress. Today, we will debate the issue of war and whether Congress is constitutionally bound to declare war. We will debate whether one generation can bind another generation to perpetual war. Within the next year, there will be people fighting who were not yet born at the time of 9/11. This war no longer has anything to do with 9/11, has no longer anything to do with any vital interest of our country. It has to do with us believing that we can reshape the world and make the world safe for democracy. Everybody's going to love America and everybody's going to become a Western-style democracy. Guess what? It's never going to happen. So what I'm advocating is a vote. For the first time in 16 years, I'm advocating we should vote on whether or not we should be at war. I think there is no greater responsibility for a legislator than to vote on when we go to war.
I think one of the problems and why maybe people haven't cared or they haven't been paying attention is maybe it feels like it's happening to some other person in some other place, somewhere we can't see, where we're not affected. And there's this whole infrastructure that's been built. You know, Guantanamo is still there. This pseudo-court military commission system to try terror suspects instead of fair trials, that's still there. This surveillance apparatus is still there. Drones are still there. An American citizen was targeted by a drone strike and killed. The idea that, like, this doesn't affect us and these weapons, you know, literal weapons and as well as metaphorical weapons that are dangerous to our rights and liberties could never be utilized against us or someone we know, I think that's really naive.
I swore to the flag, to my brothers in arms, that I would keep this land far from harm, not to die on a single man's whim, whatever country was mean to him. War's not won, 'cause this war's never done. And war's not won since 2001. Afghanistan, Libya, Pakistan, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq. Parent and child made to fight the same fight, and we don't know when they're coming back. Afghanistan, Libya, Pakistan, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq. Parent and child made to fight the same fight, and we don't know when they're coming back.
Newsbeat is produced and distributed by MP Studios, a division of Mori Publishing. The producer of Newsbeat is Michael Conforti. The editor-in-chief of Newsbeat is Christopher Tawarski. The managing editor of Newsbeat is Rashed Meehan. The executive producer of Newsbeat is Jed Mori. Show notes are available on usnewsbeat.com. Subscribe today on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.